Hello and welcome to the Audio Drama Production Podcast on the Audio Drama Network. My name is George Maddox.
And I'm Sarah. Hello. And today we have, yes, as you've heard, the amazing George Maddox. Hello, George. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Sarah.
Today we're really focusing on your fantastic skills on producing and directing. But you do have a little dabble in all sorts of other things. I shouldn't say dabble. That's not the right word I want to use. I'm going to retract that and pretend I didn't say that. You have expertise in other areas, don't you, George?
I like to be expedient where I can and save work where I can. That was always when I was producing and directing bits, I always felt that if we could get something quickly and efficiently done right there on the spot, taking a little bit of license perhaps with something, then that's the way we did it. So if, for example, you needed to rewrite a line here, or you needed to think about the way the script was structured or make a decision about a character, I tended to feel like, given the timeframes we tended to be working on, we would jump in and we would get it done. And if that meant that we slightly rewrote a scene or fiddled with something, then we would do that. I should add that we always checked with the writers after the fact. And obviously, the joy of radio drama is that if they really, really don't like it, you can always try and pick it up and re-record it later on. But yeah. Yes, I like to
fluid.
Be hands-on. Yes, yeah, completely. You know,
fluid
and it's in flux. I always liked to be hands-on. I always liked to try and get things done fast and efficiently and make decisions in the moment where I could.
Exciting. So today's focus is really on a location recording, and I am certain that most people, if not all, who are listening to this have heard of Dead London, and that's something that you were very pivotal on working on. With regards to the whole process of kind of producing something that, you know, is produced on location, could you just talk us through perhaps a timeline of events of first of all, when you've got the script, decisions that are made on where this is going to take place? So how do you start?
Well, you actually start just a little bit before the script, actually. So I think the way that started was Jack Bowman, who will maybe be a familiar name to some people on
here.
I think he said, look, there's a competition coming up in America, retelling of the War of the Worlds in 15 minutes. We know the people who run it, and, you know, we'd love to sort of yet again display something to them. He said, we know you've been doing the on-location recording thing. It seems like this is a really good application for it. And all of that conversation happened pre-script. And I make a point of noting that, because the way we did on-location, which is not the only way to do it, but the way we always did it, was we wanted everything to sound as authentic as is humanely possible, thereby you didn't choose what location you wanted and then work from there. You said, what location have I got and how can I leverage that? And so the decision was tentatively made, I think, at that first meeting. They said, well, look, the actual Horsell, I think I pronounced that correct, common from the book is actually available for our use. It's actually not far from one of the other producers' house. And his house is also large enough to accommodate a recording crew. So I said, well, look, center your story around the common, the actual arrival, and then we'll see what comes out of having someone in this large house. And
exciting.
From there, the script kind of developed, but it does betray in and of itself a kind of a truth about the way we always chose to do it, which is we always worked from what we had. So what do you have? And therefore, off the back of what you have, how do you then record in that? Because with location, what we always chose to do was we tried as little as possible to deviate from the performance that was being given on the day. So if you can get actors onto that common giving a performance about aliens landing on that common, we sought to add as little as possible to the top of that. So if a character falls over, then the character falls over, you know, and the microphone accounts for that. So having done that, Jack and Rob went away. They wrote Dead London. It was a 15-minute competition. I think they wrote about 42 minutes in the end, which is not necessarily uncommon with those guys. But but we knew that, you know, that was a known, you know, and they're always, you know, they didn't give us any flab. You know, they wrote fantastic stuff. And then from there, we contracted, not contracted, sorry, that's my official legalese creeping in. We talked to Marielle, who obviously is sort of Uber producer or anything that Marielle, Wireless does.
And she's been on here a few times, yes, good.
And then we boiled that down to, okay, right, so now we've got this script. Now we know who we need to get hold of. And between myself and Marielle, we pretty much picked people, to be honest. We were working at pretty fast speed. We didn't really have the time for the auditions. We had people in our heads who we knew could do the job. And we also kind of needed, again, this is something you do find, I think, a bit with location. We kind of needed to work with people we knew because, you know, they were going to be standing around in the cold for upwards of 12 hours, potentially getting dirty. And if it rained, that was just kind of, you know, tough.
They'd have to lump it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Plus, kind of, it was a sort of, you know, we
They're just actors, yeah.
Well, it was it was less that. It was more. We weren't rich as a company, and so there was a certain amount of this will be fine as long as everyone helps with the bags, you know. Certainly wasn't money for a sort of a trailer on location, you know. So it was going to be cold feet and please pick up the kits, you know. So we picked out the people we needed. We picked out, you know, it was one of those lucky things. I know for certain that at least two of the actors we did get, you know, I think I don't think we ever got them again afterwards because they just became too busy. So it was fantastic bit of luck that we got the cast we did. Struck out, we already had the kit. We'd had the kit from the recording of Rat, which was our sort of first prototype for this. We got Malcolm Thorpe on board, incredible editor who agreed to record on the day as well. And then from that point, we traveled down to the Common and we recorded everything we needed to record. Now, I'm just going to think carefully about this. I believe we recorded that in a day. My memories from that time are a little bit hazy because we also did a lot of visualized audio recording work as well, where we filmed a short accompanying film that went with it. And I know we did that the next weekend. So my memories get a little bit blurred, but I'm pretty sure we recorded the entirety of Dead London, everything we could have possibly needed on the Common and then back at the producer's house within the day. And we were back on the and we had time for a pint just before we got the train back.
That's why you don't remember it, because I bet it wasn't just one.
Well, we all know the drill, right? Do you know what I mean? You know, when people are working for free, you got to lay on a few beers at the end of the day, right? You know, that's the crack. So
I like those projects. Yeah,
well, yeah, that's the only way to do it, right? And you know, at the same time, it can't be too. Look, if you're putting your hand in your pocket and you're finding full rates, which, you know, we would always endeavour to do, but obviously, you know, for a 15-minute competition piece with no financial prize, there wasn't really the option. Plus, also, at the time, it was out of copyright in the US, War of the Worlds, but in copyright in the UK. So even if we'd wanted to, the monetization options were precisely zero because it was a strange situation where it was copyright in one place and not in the other. The main point was, though, that people came down. Now, at this point, having recorded it in under 24 hours, that's where the timeline stretches out a bit. Malcolm, who'd done a brilliant job with the recording, then had the utterly unenviable task of piecing that all back together. And then when he'd done that, I think it was probably the most professional edit I ever did because he very cleverly managed to find us some studio time. I don't know. I think he called in a few favors. So we actually did the full sit in the room for 6-7 hours and go through it. And then he did the first edit. I think that must have taken him about a week. And then after that, I think we had a little pause. We let it settle. And then we ended up with a 22-minute cut, which was the one that we've subsequently, I think, always used. But then we went back to the studio for 3 slightly torturous hours of cutting it down to the 15 minutes that was actually required. And that was the cut that went to Convergence and then subsequently won the award. We didn't have sounds for the aliens. We had sounds of the aliens arriving. We had sounds of the characters running and describing, oh my God, the aliens have arrived. And Jack was at the time recording a wonderful series of documentaries called Life at Death's Door, written by a lady called Anne Theato, who was calling in celebrity narrators to help promote this as part of the drive to better understand the dying and the grieving process. And they happened to have got Brian Blessed in. And they had, I think, 3 hours of studio time booked in with Brian Blessed. And Jack, in one of the breaks from recording Life at Death's Door, said, because I think Brian Blessed was in some way involved with the original War of the Worlds recordings. And I think Jack brought it up, and then Brian said something along the lines of, oh, I did the noises for the monsters. And then Jack said, well, you know, Jack essentially being Jack, managed to say, well, I don't suppose you'd possibly fancy doing the noises of the monsters for the... And he did. He absolutely did. And the noises you hear on the Dead London recording are, in fact, Brian Blessed doing the aliens. And there's a part of me that is enormously gratified to the biggest star I'll ever work with. And we just made him go... Blah, 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 blah. There's something pleasing about
that. I love
that. I feel absolutely like it's a little bit like when the guys from South Park made George Clooney play a dog, but obviously it's not quite as precise as that. So that was tapped in as well, and that was it. It won the award, and then it couldn't be released in the UK 3.5 years.
Goodness, had to wait.
Yes, we had to wait, and then we obviously now I think it's available for free. I'm sure if you follow the Twitter links, it keeps getting put out there. I think there's still a little bit of nerves in and around whether or not it's chargeable. I have not concerned myself with that side of thing. I believe it's now a common property. We had a very particular objective in mind, which was not just we stand around the mic and behave like we're in a studio, but we're not. We're on the location. It was using shotgun mounted boom mics akin to films. It was having the actors fall when the actors would fall in the play. It was having people run when they would run. It was dragging people around. It dragged people around Rob's cellar for hours on end, smashing bits of metal and having actors screaming. And we really, really committed to that style. Having committed to that style, we got just some, that's the best example of us making that work. And so for that reason, I'll always be really very proud of that. There would have been obviously a global call sheet, but that essentially boiled down to everyone turns up at the same place at the same time, because we couldn't really because people had to travel out of London. We just had to say, you arrive here at 9 o'clock in the morning at this train station. Then we all board the train together, because I'm not playing the game where... Is it this train? Oh, it's the other train. Oh, there's another actual horse up north, and et cetera, et cetera. So we met at the outbound train station, not the inbound. And then we all caught the train together. But then from that point onwards, it was, if I think about it, it was, I don't want to say meticulously planned, because it sounds like I'm kissing my own bottom, but we had to be intensely precise on what we did and where, down to the fact that we actually recorded a scene during the drive to the common, because there's a scene in the car, right?
Yes, because I was going to ask you about that. Yes, because it's all on location, so you must have recorded in the car. Yes.
Yes. Good. So
that was on the way.
as we drove to the location.
Efficiency.
It was like, well, quite, right? I mean, that's the whole point. You say, well, look, I've got a 20-minute drive. I could sit there thinking, God, this is a waste of time, or I could get a scene down. And the way we did it, we had someone driving, and then we had the two actors in the back, and then we had the boom stuffed between the seats. I still can't quite work out how we would have done it, because it feels like we need an extra person. But we had, I think maybe I might have manned the boom, or Malcolm might have sat in between the actors in the back of the. So the recorder will, I think sat between the actors in the back of the car as they did the performance as the car was driving. And then we will have wild recorded a bunch of gear changes and things like that, which we could have thrown in off the top. And then obviously we probably did a bit of open engine noise when we actually got there. But broadly speaking, it was Tom Slatter and Josephine Arden who did that scene. And obviously for those guys, they did just smashed it out of the park, because it's not actually that easy to to do, right? You know, to suddenly take all these skills you've learned where you stand with your diaphragm open and you have your feet set and you say, oh, I'm this far from the mic and I project like this and I engage my core. You can't do any of that. You're cramped in a car with a sound guy and he's waving a boom mic in your face and you can't kind of touch anything. And so they did fantastic. And I mean,
how much rehearsal did they have as well? Because that's what I wanted to pick up from earlier, the sort of structure of things. So what had they done previous to this day's shoot or recording?
None whatsoever. We did nothing. Okay. So that was the other thing. I mean,
time and money constraints, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I suppose it's worth touching on all of this. So at the time, we were aware that coming round the corner was streaming media, right? And viral media by extension.
Yes.
But it wasn't as yet established in the public consciousness so much as a thing. And we knew that in the past, wireless had always done things like Springheel, you know, where, you know, it's incredible. I mean, brilliant piece of work. But I mean, I think it took Jack and Rob about 5 years, right? And if you applied that to the new sort of streaming mindset that came up, which is, you know, 3 bits of content a day, right, for your audience. Yes. We knew that that wouldn't work. So we started working on incredibly cut down timeframes. So we recorded War of the Worlds in a day because that was the most efficient way to do that. But before that, we had recorded a show called a piece called Rat. And the Rat, we had deliberately constrained ourselves with 48 hours to perform, edit, and then release.
Wow.
And that was a deliberate, we didn't need to do it that fast, but we set ourselves the challenge to say, can we turn this round in 48 hours? And the whole thought was, okay, well, if we could, then how much media can we knock out? And that also tied into the on location thinking, because you say, well, if I'm going to make a piece of work and knock it out in 48 hours, actually, you know, I can't, you know, studio time's a pain in the backside. It's hard to put it all together. It's got a cost associated with it. I want to be making lots of this stuff and fast. Well, it doesn't cost you anything to stand in the street. You know, you have a single cost for a boom, a single cost for a recording brick and a couple of Lavalier microphones. That's a one-off cost. You can get 17 pieces out of that. You make a piece every weekend. Now, it didn't work out like that in the end, which, you know, is often the case with something that new. And in the end, you know, frankly, we wouldn't have wanted to play on the streaming media networks, you know?
Right. Going
viral is, as we know, an exercise in finding someone falling off a treadmill, setting it to a laugh track, you know, and then watching that sweet, sweet AdSense money roll in. And we didn't want to play that game, and that was just fine. But, you know, we had done what we could to put ourselves in that park if we wanted to. So the reason that there was no rehearsal was that we'd found on Rat that it was superfluous. You know, it just didn't need to happen. If that scene in the car is 5 minutes, I can get three or four takes of that. Yeah, if you've got the right actors who know what they're about, then they can get it into, you know. Mm. And the other thing is, because the immediacy of location recording is so immediately intimate, it's actually so much easier for them to bleed that performance in, right? There's no kind of, oh, there's a pop on the mic, oh, there's a bit of a bump. You're in a car, dude. Do you know what I mean? You know, it makes no difference. Unless someone actually physically smacks the end of the boom, you're going to be sweet. So, you know, there was a certain amount of you just didn't need that rehearsal time because, you know, the actors knew what they were about. Everything was there. The only thing I think we did spend more time on was the scenes in the cellar that Josie did. And that was just because they're the kind of emotional meat and drink of the piece.
Yeah.
So I think we were in that cellar for about 3.5 hours.
Okay.
Because we needed to, because she needed the time to find that performance, you know. But other than that, no, we just threw people in cold and trusted they knew what they were doing. And by that point, we were so, as a unit, we were so kind of slick. We hadn't, and that's again one of the reasons why I think we went and picked people straight off the bat, because you can't end up in that situation and then find that one of the actors actually is a bit like, I think I'll be fine, but can we pull over the car? Do you know what I mean? So I can do some, I don't know, stretches or whatever. You know, we just knew that we had down-to-earth, straightforward people who were just going to get the job done, you know?
Yeah, I know loads of actors like that.
So yeah, it's really gratifying, isn't it? And it makes everything so much easier. And so with that in mind, when you are working with actors like that, just to go back to where we were with the scheduling, it was scheduled down to the to the nth degree, right? But the other reason why we could get away, there was no contingency, right? I don't think we're going to make a mistake. You know, it was like there is no contingency, that everything is a live environment. But we knew we could do it because we knew that everyone would get their job done. And I think that was one of the other things we were really big on at the time. We used to say, we're all here to have fun, but it's fun when you do your job right. In terms of things we had to solve on the feet, I think there were a few. If I think back, and it was a while back, there were a couple of occasions where I think Malcolm just said, if the environment is this real, I cannot layer things in post. They will sound horrendous.
Right.
And so the one thing that we did have to do, which actually I've got some footage of it somewhere, I should really dig it out. We were down in the cellar, and we had to try and, we had imagined that Malcolm would be able to layer in the sounds of the crafts arriving. And okay. He sort of just said, look, I'm good, but I can't take the sound of a spaceship arriving and lay it over the top of something that sounds this kind of visceral and real. I can tell you at this point it's not going to work. And so we said, well, okay, how do we fix this? Now, the nice thing about the cellar was it was full of weird old hand pressing machines. I don't know what they were down there for, but it was like old printing press stuff. So stuff with pulleys and wheels and all sorts of stuff was down there. It was largely metal. And so what we did,
we're not judging.
Oh no, there's no judgment at all. I mean, it was all there for a purpose. It just hadn't been used for the purpose for a while. So we started trying to think, well, can we make the alien noises with that? So I think Rob started turning one of the cranks, and the crank made a certain pitch of a noise, and that was useful. Some of the other axes started sort of rocking things back and forth in the same way you would if something large was landing overhead. And then in the end, when Josie is dragged away, we did two takes of that, one in which Josie was sort of grabbed by someone and dragged, so you can hear her feet scraping across the floor. Yes, but then we found a knackered old bit of metal, and we dragged it in the same position and in the same time. So that sounds like the scraping of something picking her up and carrying her off. So actually, you know, when it does come down to it, you know, I think that was the one of the things we just managed to solve along the way.
Improvised. You know? So it helps having the editor of the piece there to give you that then and there, doesn't it?
Because
I think that, and that's really important, I think, because a lot of people have asked, you know, regards peopling a location recording. Did it ever feel very crowded, or were you able to kind of resource people out and kind of get the space to do what you wanted to do with the piece?
I think it would have felt crowded was I not working with people I trusted quite so implicitly. And that's, again, another reason I think we chose people. Being in that cellar for 3.5 hours, I used to live with Josie before I worked with her. We knew each other very well. I knew Marielle very well at that point. In fact, everyone on that shoot was a very close friend or someone I worked with an awful lot professionally. And I think you do need that. It's a bit damp. It's a bit dusty. You've done 6-7 hours of recording straight. You're already a bit, I remember being just knackered and from concentrating so hard on the details. And so the trick really is, you should probably, as a general piece of advice, obviously you've always got to bring in a variety of people, and you've always got to be open to new people, because new people bring the most wonderful things. But if you are working hard and fast on a tight deadline, which is often the way with location because of all the other stuff that comes in, you absolutely do have to have people who you sort of say, well, actually, I can spend 3 hours in the cellar with that person, and it won't be either A, weird, or B, suddenly halfway through they won't have a complete fit and go, this is ridiculous, you know. And you have to have that level of trust, you know. But that's once you do have that, and you have that with your working crew, if you're looking to set up, you know, location based stuff, once you have that, your options sort of go through the roof, you know. And certainly in the scene with Josie, you know, there were moments where it was kind of just me and her kind of crouched in the corner of the room, and everyone else just being very quiet, and the I still think there are performances that can be brought out of that that actors would have found in a different way on stage, but there's nothing mm-hmm. quite like playing someone crouched in a cellar when you are someone crouched in a cellar, right? You know, that opens up a whole new layer of things. In fact, actually, just to go back to your other point, just in case there is anyone here who listened to the piece, if you are looking for an example of adaptation, look out for the line, "This is ridiculous, there are children over there." And the reason why that line is in there is not because we wrote it, but because there were children and they were playing very loudly and we couldn't keep them off the recording. So early in the scene, we have, and unfortunately for me, that line sounds horrendous because I know, right? But, every time we would strike up this scene where we say, I think the original line the major has is that, this area had been sealed off for 10 miles as soon as we heard there was an alien here. And then the background, you'd hear someone go, "Mummy, he's got the ball." You're like, right, well, that's not going to play. So again, a bit of swift rewriting on the spot. And we said, "This is ridiculous, you know, officer, you know, clear this area. There's children over there, you know." And that's, again, you know, you got to be on your feet, right? You know, you just got to adapt, you know.
Because I was going to ask you about obviously the chase scenes and the screaming and things externally. Mm. Did you have an audience for that? You know, did you have to speak to passers-by and people just to, you know, inform them what was happening? Did you have to get permissions or police help or anything else to, you know, not seal off areas, but be aware of this is what was happening and why in case someone did call the police on you?
Not on that. So that actually took place in a garden, the chase mm-hmm. scene, and the garden was okay. relatively secluded from everyone else.
Okay.
So, again, a very fond memories of recording that. I think we saved that for the last of the daylight before we went down to the cellar. And everyone, there's a picture out there somewhere, and you can see Josie running. Josie's a marathon runner, so she can run at fair clip. And then behind you can see Malcolm, the sound guy, who's carrying all his sound kit that's kind of bouncing off him, and he's trying to keep up. And alongside, everyone else is running as well. And I think we even choreographed it so people ran around. And that's sort of what I mean about the way the sound was done, right? We needed people running in and out. And in fact, some of them were stationary, so that she would run past people screaming in a stationary position, you know. Which was fine for Josie, because she can literally run marathons, but poor old Malcolm, he was knackered, you know. And again,
come and get fit and do audio drama, wear yes. all this kit and run around, lose some pounds.
Well, precisely, and it was just one of those, you know, it's not usual for, you know, that to crop up, you know. And that's again the benefit of working with people who are sort of understand that they might end up, you know, having to run
active.
About. Yeah. With regard to location permissions, the actual things that we found we had to be careful were not anything to do with the sound recording, but when we did the visualization of the, we did the visualization piece, which is a video track that went along with the radio piece and complemented it with, mm-hmm. but had a different strain of action that happened in the same time frame as the piece. Which was at the time the BBC would be big into visualized audio, and we kind of wanted to break into that. So we recorded that. Now, when we did that, we created a series of mock tweets, and then we recorded the screen of a computer where the mock tweets were coming up on. And of course, we were putting things like, "Oh, they're coming down the road, we're trapped in the rubble." And we had to pretty much immediately stop it, because we had 5 or 6 people pop up and be like, "What the hell's going on? What's wrong?"
Okay.
Which is eerily reminiscent, of course, of the Orson Welles radio broadcast. So there was that. And I think then some of the other stuff we did around that time where we were filming, obviously that's when, what I would say as a general rule, pick your location so that no one cares if you're brandishing around a boom mic, and watch out particularly for areas that look like public areas but are in fact private property. So somewhere like, for example, 3 More London down by London Bridge, that's actually private property. If you are someone who's into location recording, if this is something you want to do, you can be fairly unobtrusive with lavalier mics. The minute you pop out a boom mic, people will be on you. Yeah. Just do it somewhere where no one could possibly have any objections.
Claudia Elvidge asks, "Do you have a recommended kit for recording on location? And how does this differ from the equipment you use for recording in a controlled space?"
I had a film crew onto one of the sites I managed at the time. And I watched them bring in loads of lights and loads of cameras and loads of stuff. And then they had one sound guy, and he had a satchel. And in that satchel, he had, you know, one of those generic recording bricks, probably a Fostex or some sort of Tascam unit, the one that's got eight XLRs on the bottom and manageable controls on the top. He had his boom mic, and then he had Lavalier mics for all of his actors, right? People set up reams and reams of lights and, you know, two cameras and did white balancing. He was set up in about 10 minutes and he was sat on his ass, picking his nose, right? Because he was done, yeah? Because that's all you need to get literally broadcast quality audio. You got one of those recording bricks, you've got the WAVs you need. You've got enough inputs on that recording brick, then you're set and you're good to go. Now, as it happened, we couldn't afford one of those, so we went with a smaller model. I think we went with a Tascam DR100, but you could also use a Zoom. It doesn't really matter what you use as long as it's got XLR inputs. Mm-hmm. And then what you do off the back of that is you plug in a boom mic. We used a Rode NTG2 because it came as part of a reasonable package. And then what you can throw in on top is a couple of wired Lavalier mics, which clip to your actors, which will give you a bit of backup in case you don't get the boom where you need it. And that, for the time I was sort of working with wireless, but that was all we ever used. Mm-hmm. However, what I would caution for those people who are saying, okay, well, that's good, that leads to a very particular style of recording, a very intimate, very real style of recording that in which the performance of the scene needs to be right on the day. Doesn't leave your editor much room for chipping and chopping around afterwards. Yeah. Right. However, if you make peace with that, then I'd say set yourself up with a Tascam or a Zoom with XLR input, chuck a boom mic on top, a couple of decent pairs of headphones. You only really need headphones for your audio guy and for your director. You know, your actors don't need to be hearing it back because they, you know, in my philosophy, they should just be feeling the relationship between the other people. It's for you to get the mic in the right place. Yeah, and that's the difference with a studio. In a studio, it's about the actor getting the right distance to the mic. On location, you get that mic where that actor needs it because that actor is performing into the world, you know? Mm-hmm. And then after that, once you've got it all down and in the can, you're just going to need a MacBook. A MacBook and whatever your editing platform of choice is, although we always ran on Pro Tools. You know, a recording brick with XLR inputs of any sort of size or scale, as long as it would record WAVs, a boom mic, a couple of Lavalier mics, if you want, you can choose to do without, sturdy sets of headphones. Mm-hmm. Don't buy cheap ones. It's a complete hostage to fortune. They're going to get stepped on. All this kit is going to get stepped on, it's going to get dropped, and it's going to get beaten around. So where possible, try and avoid the, I can get two sets of headphones for 15 quid on eBay. Well, yeah, you can, but then you're going to be doing a scene where you go down a stairwell and you're going to twist it at a funny angle. And now, oops, it's either the director and or the other guy who can monitor it, you know? Mm-hmm. So one thing we were always pretty hot on was we always had good quality headphones so we could hear what was going on.
Excellent. I know a lot of people would be pleased to hear that.
yeah, absolutely. And I'd hesitate to call it a pro tip, but a solid tip is look for the Shure SE215s, which are in-ear headphones, but they have replaceable cables because the earbud can be detached from the cable. So I've got a pair of 215s. I think I've had them for coming up to 6 years. I've changed the cable 4 times on them. But the cable gets changed, the earbud remains constant. I would say script noise issues. I don't think at the time, it was a bit before they happened, but iPads, the seller wasn't very bright, but you know, we managed to find a way to make that work. And in terms of noise muffling, your reasonably priced boom mic, obviously in our case, the NTG2, but pretty much anything you get is going to come with the Fuzzy Cat. And we always found that the Fuzzy Cat was more than enough. If you phone up any of the camera hire places in London and tell them you just want to hire a boom mic and all the accessories, then they'll get kind of confused and go, I've no idea how to cost that, mate. No one wants that by themselves, and you'll probably get a bargain. At which point, that will then come with a plethora of, You get the fuzzy cat, which is the foam muffler that goes on the end. But then you also, I think, get a much more expansive one that goes around like a cone, which can even cut out even more sound. And then finally, the thing to remember, of course, is a bit of wind noise isn't necessarily as obtrusive in a live environment as it was in the studio. Yeah.
You know,
Yes. Well, precisely that. Do you know what I mean? You know, is it windy on the day? If it's windy when you record, it's windy in the scene. You know.
And the other question that Henry Howard asked is, did you do continuous scene takes or lots of short sections?
I think we must have done it 3, maybe 4 times. So it's about a 5-minute scene before being chopped, obviously. So we would have gone through it the way I chose to usually work at the time. We'd have gone through it 3 times and then I would have taken some notes. And then if something had gone badly wrong on all 3 takes, I would have done a cut in for anything I needed to do, and that would have been the picture for the day. So we would always, and more, I would have divided the script up. So we would have had scenes within scenes, but to answer his question, as much as you can get recorded in one go is the better way to do it, because obviously your actors will change position because it's much more dynamic environment. So actually longer takes are really the way for location stuff, because it's so much harder if your actor was previously 2 steps back and then there were 3 steps back on the next one. So we didn't do every scene top to bottom all the way through. I think that's impractical, you know, especially in a live environment. But where possible, we did try and do as big chunks as we possibly could, saving the cutaways for later on. Because, you know, to a certain extent, that's the location way. The actors are giving the performance. You want them to just flow through that performance as much as possible with as little stops as is possible.
How much would you go through the script with the actor before they roved in the space? And how much information would you give them about, you know, hit points as to where you wanted them to head for, go to, and so on?
So I would block it pretty much like out of, because, you know, I did do my time directing for the stage. I would pretty much block these things like I would block a scene. The good scene for that is the scene where they discover the alien itself. We'd found a bit of land that was kind of sandy, which meant that the actors could kind of drop to their knees when possible. Okay, you need to sound like you're climbing something. So what if we start off with you? You wouldn't climb the hill in real time because that won't sound quite right. So I think we started off with Josie and Matthew taking really protracted kind of baby steps in the sand with the boom mic angled aggressively down at their feet. And then we brought it up to their mouths when they started talking.
Right.
So that blocking, the way I did it, encompassed not only what I wanted the actors to do, but also what Malcolm needed to do with the microphone itself. So it wasn't just that you were blocking the actor, you're also blocking the mic guy. So you say, okay, you guys start stamping, right? And then I'll wave the arm. And having waved the arm, the mic comes up. When the mic comes up, Josie, you start talking. Then the mic moves to Matthew. And then Matt, if you are 2 steps behind them, can you give a bit of noise from back there? Because I want you to be further back. And then all the time we're doing this, we all walk as a 3 up the hill till we get to the top and then you stop. Now, you know, that is not quite the same as saying we're going to climb this hill all together and that you're going to record it, Malcolm, because the hill, the length of distance covered was probably less than 2 meters. But everything that they did in that time was very heavily controlled from an audio perspective. And I think that's what I mean about having 2 sets of headphones. You've got to have a set and the audio guy has to have a set, because you're kind of blocking their movements in line with what you hear, not what you see. And so a lot of what we tried to do when we recorded the location stuff was say, okay, at this point in time, which character is the audience listening with? So for a lot of that, you're listening kind of as Josie, right? You know, so she's kind of we're hearing what she would hear, because the mic is focused on her. And but, you know, she's still an external voice. It's not designed to be in her head, but she's the focal point. Everyone moves around her. So if Matt needs to be distant from her, he's distant from her. Now, occasionally you'd flip mid-scene and you'd make it that Josie goes off into the wilderness and we stay with And we stay with Paul, let's say, for a second, when Paul approaches the landed alien rocket. And in a way, the way it sort of profited me to try and think about it was like you were doing a one-shot film. You pick who you're listening with, and then you make the mic reflect their location in the space, and things move around them.
And could you give us two further top tips, if you will, for people who are perhaps about to embark on their location recording as to best practice? What do they need to do, do you think, to get either the best out of their actors, the space, or the day?
It is meticulous planning. So the thing with location is the threshold for all of this is unusable is so much higher because it's so much harder to cut things in afterwards, right? So wherever you turn up and however you're going to do it, you got to have an absolutely rock solid tight plan for getting that 75% of the final artistic product done, right? It's the travel logistics, it's the spreadsheets, it's how long will this scene take to record, you know? Can I do it in 20 minutes? Can I do it in that time? Data offload, batteries, yeah? You got to take all that into consideration. So the Tascam runs off an internal battery, but when that's dead, it's dead. Yeah, so you want another one of those, it's another 70 quid for another one of those, right? And then you can move to the Zoom, but the Zoom has got slightly different audio properties, right? So you've got to have enough batteries in the bag, yeah? And that's just one of the areas, yeah? Does your boom mic need a battery because it's condenser? Yes, it does, you know? Or it's pulling phantom from the unit and then it's dead, right? You know, can you charge the things in the car using the cigarette lighter? Yes, absolutely, but then someone's got to stay with the car because you've got to run the engine, you know? Security, basic security. Yeah. Yes. Ultimately, this is not expensive kit, but you say, okay, right, everyone take five. That's great. You know what I mean? Smoke if you've got them. Oh, who was looking after the kit? Oh, where is the kit? Oh, hell. Right. So, you know, you've got to get that all down. You've almost got to think of it as like a film shoot, you know, that level of planning. And then I suppose if that's the first tip, then I would say the second tip is the diametric opposite. Finding what you have on the day and making the absolute best of it, you know. So the stuff we found in the cellar, for example, you know, that worked really well. Being loose, you know, accepting that this is a much less controlled environment than you're used to. This is a much more open environment. Things are going to happen that aren't good, and some things that are going to happen that are good. Turn your actors loose, essentially.
Hooray!
Yeah, completely.
Wanted.
Yeah,
they have to keep their clothes on though, really, most of
well,
the time.
Well, it is audio, depends, you know, right? If they're comfy, right? Yeah.
You mean you didn't do it all naked? I imagined it completely wrong.
turn them loose, do what they got to do and let that organically happen, you know. And if they stumble, maybe the character stumbled. If something interesting happens, then something interesting happens, you know. And I think that's the other joy of it, you know. That's the thing you're never going to get around. And what I would say as well is, and this sort of goes back to really where we started a little bit, if something happens that's super useful, now, for example, the kids playing for us wasn't super useful, but we made something of it, you know, if something happens that's super useful and you need to start taking a pen to the script, I would argue take a pen to the script. This isn't studio, right? You can't be expected to get that pitch perfect result. What you can be expected to get is a raw, organic thing that records that time and that place and that space in which you were recording. And if it says, well, hell, we're going to have to take a few lines to this monologue, then do it, you know? You know, when it comes down to it, a lot of the stuff that turns out to be some of the very best bits of the art, the stuff you didn't plan at all, it's just the stuff that happened. And it's very difficult to see how in a studio there's so many less options in a studio for something magic happening, you know. But if it starts to rain just at the most dramatic point of the scene, yeah, well, then throw a Mac over the mic and go, well, this is what this scene's in the rain now. And if that means that the actor has to chuck in a few lines about, this is ridiculous, we got to stand out here, Gary, we're getting really wet, you know, then do it, you know. If it's not dynamic, if it's not moving like that, why do it on location? You know, head for your safe space in the studio, man. You know, if you want to get out there and really do it, get out there and do it. You know, do, and again, it goes a little bit back to what I was saying before. Come up with the idea, then examine the locations you have, and then work within the locations you have. Don't say, I have set this thing upon, oh, I don't know, off the top of my head, a spaceship. Now I have to find somewhere that sounds like a spaceship. Because if you're going to do that, you'd be better off hitting up a studio, right? Because then, you know, you can use an archetypal spaceship sound. It will confuse people less. Yeah. What you have to do is say, okay, I have this story. I have this story I want to tell. I have this house I can tell it in. I have this swimming pool that is disused that I can use. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How do those two things fit together? Does the swimming pool become a morgue? That sounds like an acoustic fit. Yeah. Don't try and don't have an objective you're trying to pull out the location. Have the sound of the location and the concept you want to achieve and mix the two.
But I have one final question for you, if I may.
Of course.
From somewhere, in, I don't know, she sounds very nice, Marielle Rennecke-Beck, I think her name is. She sounds nice enough. What was your favourite memory of the Dead London recording?
So I think on the actual day of the recording, when we recorded the audio play, it was the making of that alien sound organically using the stuff we found in the cellar, because it wasn't just like two people. We had the entire, and this is a bit like what I mean about the blocking, right? So we had my mate Tom, who had the metal that would drag along the floor. We had someone else who was literally sort of holding Josie by the shoulders and was going to drag her out. Then we had the guys who were rocking the bits of shelves and clanking the bits and bobs or whatever else. Mm-hmm. And essentially we blocked it, right? We said, okay, so you go with that and you go with that. And I was sort of in the middle pointing at people going, okay, now a bit of that, now a bit of that, now a bit of that. Now you start streaming, pointing at people, not saying anything, but pointing. And it was just... I remember being surrounded by people who I trusted, right? Who were friends, but also I trusted them and they were friends, but they were also really, really good at what they did, which is why this was working. We had another moment like that when we recorded the visualized audio, where we got to the final sort of climactic scene where everyone's dead, and we had to essentially cover the whole place in blood. And have a load of dead bodies that the characters sort of climbed over as they went up the stairs. And essentially, we knew we needed to rip clothes, so I'd brought a load of my old shirts. So we kind of put everyone in my old shirts, and then we kind of tore them, and we chucked this blood on everyone, and we lay them all on the stairs. And it was exactly the same thing at the end of that. I remember we'd set off a green smoke bomb as well, which had filled the place. And I remember the place, we got the final take. We did a single shot leading all the way up the stairs. We got that take in the bag. And, you know, the guy was filming, my very good friend Aaron, who I run the company I have with now, he said, it's done, it's cut, it's perfect. You know, we've got everything we need. And it was the same thing again, just looking around at all these people kind of covered in fake blood, wearing my shirts, being like, we did it. Well, it was all hugs all around. But it was not just in doing something fun with friends. It was achieving something very difficult for no money and with no resource with professional colleagues who were getting their job right. And on both occasions. Yeah, I'm sure you know what I mean. I was just
going to say, you've just summed up exactly what audio drama is like at the minute for most people, I think.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
that was it. Yeah.
No, there were good times always round. And the piece of art at the end of it, I think does justice to that, you know.
Superb. Well, we certainly need you to get behind a bit of audio kit again, I think, because, you know, that's such a very cool production, and it is brought out on many occasions to, you know, cited as an excellent example of how you can do brilliant audio. So thank you for all your hard work on that. And as I say, good luck with all your other adventures that are happening right now. And thank you very much for talking to us.
Well, it's been absolutely my pleasure. And listen, thank you so much for having me on, because actually, it was a while back, and a lot of stuff, it doesn't, you never lose the memories, right? But sometimes you don't dredge them up for a while. And actually, it's been a real pleasure reliving it. And actually, yeah, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, it's made me think, awesome. It's silly that I haven't done something like that for a while. So.
Yeah, come on, crack on again. Right? We want to see your next thing advertised on our websites for all your cast and crew.
Well, if it all comes together, I promise you'll be the first to know.
100%. Woohoo! Super. Well, thank you so much. Have fun.
You too. Thanks, Sarah. Thank you.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.